Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good evening, everybody from Chicago. I'd like to welcome Mr. Bruce Rotan from Cyberproof. He is the CISO of the company. And today's podcast, we'll be talking about a wide variety of issues. Bruce, thanks for your time, and let's go ahead and get started, please.
Thank you.
Yeah, so, what's your background? Yeah, what's your background in cybersecurity, and how did your career develop? And if you can tell us through, like, the major milestones in it, that'd be great.
Okay. Well, interestingly, I started out in programming and development, working on applications, then moved into operating system code and system utilities. And even at that point, I had an interest in how to break that code in order to exploit the system or take over a system. But when I was working on system utilities, I did a lot of work in network-based utilities. So I transitioned out of strictly development and code to networking, became a network engineer after 10 years of programming. Did that for about 15 years until I saw that Ethernet and BGP were going to win the network wars, and all the other protocols were going to be sidelined or disappear, and it became a lot less interesting. So I kind of regenned my interest in security, and that's where I've been focused for the past 22, 23 years, and it started out really in network infrastructure and security infrastructure and also pen testing, but that quickly evolved into security management. And, of course, security management, the focus of security management is facilitating risk management, so you can't really get involved in risk management if you don't step into compliance and audit. So that kind of rounded out my background and led me to the current position that I have as a company's chief trust officer and CISO. And interestingly enough, I just was at a CISO conference yesterday and kind of did some polling, and what I find over the years is that most people in the CISO role now have a really mixed background, networking, some development, a lot of people in risk and compliance path, but a really varied background. But I think in the end it's kind of essential in order to understand the business as well as the technology and marry that together through risk management and compliance.
Okay, excellent. Now, here's an off-the-cuff question I just thought of. We know that CISOs are, like, under the microscope, you know, for making sure everything's done properly. What are the trends you're seeing with, like, the overall CISO role? Is that kind of like a dying trend now, and more people are leaning towards becoming like a vCISO?
I'm seeing a lot of that in the consulting arena, but I agree with Gartner and Forrester both that the CISO role is in a transition stage, and it's really evolving into what's called chief trust officer, because the CISO role wears so many hats. There is a great deal of risk management. There's also compliance management. So a lot of the CISOs are chief compliance officer as well, chief risk officer as well. And since trust is so integral now to the business in gaining the trust of your customers, employees, partners, in order to effectively run the business, I think it's going to evolve into that. And then the chief trust officer will be overseeing the security chief information security officer as well as all of those other roles. So I think it's broadening out.
Okay, excellent. Sounds great. Now, the cyber threat landscape, you know, threat variants, they're always changing, but it seems like ever since the COVID-19 pandemic in the, 2020, it's really changed quite a bit, ransomware attacks really picked up, and so forth. What do you see some of the biggest security changes from your career, and what are the most pressing challenges?
Well, I think that a lot of people focus on the micro trends and the most recent change. And so I think one of the things that's most interesting, and I get this perspective, having been in the business for quite some time now, is that there are some higher-level changes, some macro changes and macro trends that are occurring. Obviously, one of those is the evolution with AI. We can talk about that a little bit later. But instead of really focusing on the attack du jour and what type of latest tool is out there for cyber defense, what I'm seeing is a more broad-scale change in integrating security back in integrating security into the business. And I think there's going to be a significant change over the next couple of years in terms of looking at security maturity and breaking it into some very specific areas like communications maturity, business alignment maturity, and performance and financial maturity. I can talk a little bit more about each of those, but think about how security people talk to the business and talk to the rest of the industry. And throughout, I would say, the late 90s, early 2000s, up through the mid to 20-teens, a lot of the conversation was around, here's the technology, you don't understand it, you don't need to understand it, just give me the budget, I'll go take care of it, my technical people understand this. And the measurement of success was, well, we haven't been hacked. And that's not really the communication that's going to be expected going forward. Most of the people on the board, most of the executive leadership, most companies now, they're really aware of cybersecurity. And so the education level of the business in general has gone up, and that means the way we have to, as security professionals, communicate with the business is changing. And along with that change comes the alignment of security to the business. And one of the things that's going to drive that is starting to ask, well, why are we doing this? What's the value of it to the company? We've seen that. I actually kind of like to frame it in three ways. One is, how does the initiative, any security initiative, any security project, how does this project measurably reduce the business risk and potential for loss? And how does this initiative measurably make work easier? We should be making things easier and more efficient for the employees. And how will this initiative build trust with our prospects, customers, employees, partners? And if the project you're working on, security project or initiative you're working on, doesn't effectively answer one of those three questions, you're working on the wrong project, or you're working on something that's not really aligned to the business and to business value. And we think about measurably reducing the potential loss for the business. We need to look at how we're prioritizing aligning our controls to the business. And when you think about that, one of the biggest ones, and this has come up recently with some unnamed companies' hacks, and that's aligning cyber resilience. And since we can't be assured of stopping all attacks, it's super critical that we plan on how the organization's going to weather a serious attack. So think redundancy, resilience, restoration, and don't get too fixated on the preventive controls, because those, as you said, those are the things that are going to change most frequently. Instead, we need to be really obsessive about the ability to detect something suspicious that might be the precursor to the disaster, and then how we're going to really quickly respond to that in a well-planned, well-orchestrated way that minimizes the damage. Those are a couple of the areas where I see the business and the industry really changing to become much more aligned to the company and to change our way of communication.
Okay, excellent. Now, what are some of the technology trends that you're seeing in general?
Again, it's there's the big macro technology changes. I mean, think about back in the late 90s, the SIMs were just starting to come out. Doing log management really is all it amounted to. And then in the mid-teens, everybody was migrating to the cloud. And there was a lot of fuss about, the world's going to be completely different. Everything's going to be different. We're all migrating to the cloud. And at that point in time, I actually sold cloud services through a company I was working with, Terramark and Verizon. And we did explain it very differently, made it look and sound very differently. But over time, people came to realize, okay, wait a minute, it's just somebody else's data center. This whole concept of cloud, there's no cloud. There's somebody else's data center, and I'm getting resources in that. And so that was but it did create a fundamental shift in how we do protection. We took the same tools and we changed those tools slightly to work more effectively in the cloud. So there hasn't been a radical shift. You still do host intrusion detection. You still do network intrusion detection. You still do DLP detection, but you do it with tools that are in the cloud. You still look at anomalies that are happening. You still look at identity management. You just do it a little bit differently doing it in the cloud. And that same twist is probably going to happen over the next several years with AI. It's not going to fundamentally change the tool set. You're still looking for unauthorized logins. You're still looking for compromised accounts. You're still looking for data that's leaking out in one form or another. You're trying to do rights management to track data that you own, track information that you own. You're still looking at intrusion detection. It's just going to be faster. And again, we can talk a little bit more about some of the trends in that area, what's happening in AI, but it's not going to change the fundamental tool set. And that's, again, why I say don't get too spun on the particular tools, the particular technologies, because those are going to shift rapidly and unpredictably.
Mm-hmm.
So what you really need to be fixated on is, are your processes right? If you don't have a security mentality within the organization, and I say it because think back about most of the major hacks that have happened over the past 20 years. What was the real root cause? And 90% of the time, the real root cause was the human element, right? So security has to be part of the culture. And the other root cause of the impact, when you think about the what happened, yes, they probably started with a human gap in security. Then advanced to using some technology, but then the real impact was the result of not being prepared. And so if I think about the two things that have been the most significant, there's the lack of security culture in most organizations, the lack of security awareness to stop that initial foothold, and then the lack of preparation and response to see how you're going to prepare, how you're going to deal with it. And that's what's generated the massive impact of a lot of these ransomware attacks, for instance. And we started doing things a little bit differently when ransomware attacks first came out 15 years ago. And people were saying, well, let's do offsite backup. And just those types of plans just escalate. We'd start doing off-site backups every week, hold it for 30 days on a 30-day rotation. What happened? Obviously, the bad guys got smart to that and made their timers in the ransomware 35 days. when you see some problem, you reload your data, and the timer is right back in there. You just reloaded their ransomware, and in 5 days, you really get hit again. So that constant escalation is going to continue, constant change of tool sets, but the best course of action is to get the processes right, to get security awareness right, and to come up with a plan on how you're going to weather that attack, because you're never going to stop all of the attacks. Hopefully that makes sense in the context of the question you were asking.
Oh, definitely, yes. I've met
literally in the past 22 years, hundreds of security professionals, managers in security departments. And one of the other things I found really surprising is the number of people in security positions that don't really fully understand the value chains within their company. And this goes back to the business alignment. They're not exactly sure how their company makes money, the details around it, where all the critical assets are, how they're used by the company to make money. And when they don't understand the business processes, then it's really challenging to be able to create security processes that enable the business processes but also protect the business processes. I'll give you some classic examples. Manufacturing company, for instance, a number of cases like this where I've asked, where's the critical intellectual property? And they'll say, it's in data center XYZ over here, and that's where we keep all of our really critical intellectual property, and I can show you how it's all locked down. Great. Okay, so how many factories do you have? Oh, we have factories all around the world. We've got 10, 12, 15 factories all around the world. Okay, interesting that your factories can actually manufacture your products without having the design specifications, without having that intellectual property. And the sudden realization comes over them, wait a minute, yeah, we probably are sending the design specs and a lot of that intellectual property, oh my God, all over the world to all of those places. And it's when that realization happens, you start getting that alignment to the business. This is how my business is actually operating, and this is where the data flows actually exist based on how my business is operating. Then you get a better appreciation for what you need to do in order to defend it. Mm-hmm. So sorry for the interruption. Go ahead.
No. That sounds excellent. Cool. So what advice do you have for security leaders in terms of running security more efficiently? I mean, we just talked about, the trends of CISO, but what about the IT security teams and, all the other relevant, parties that go with that?
Well, a part of it is it all stems back to changing how we communicate to the business. And when you think about efficiency and effectiveness, how are you measuring that? And how are you communicating that value? If you were to ask a lot of the board members of major organizations and the executives, how effective is your information security management program? How effective are your security leaders? I think they would be baffled by that question because we don't, as security professionals, provide them with a lot of insight into how we measure how efficient we are or how effective we are. And that goes back to that, how we measurably reduce business risk. And that's a tricky one because you'll find there's literally dozens of risk management models that try and evaluate different types of adverse situations and evaluate damage. And most of them, I'll be honest, in my opinion, most of them are wrong. They're looking at ALEs and such, calculating the loss and trying to put it into dollars is probably not right. And a lot of the companies that are doing this now They're doing averages across many different companies and taking historical data, but every company is unique in the type of data they have and the type of business disruption that attack might create. So the valuation should really be pretty straightforward in terms of relativity. There's things that will be fairly low impact, but understanding what that impact will be to the business, higher impact, medium impact, higher impact, and just critical to the business stopping. And that should provide a mechanism for focusing on where to apply controls and where to apply resources. But part of this has to link back to, again, how do we align to the business? And a lot of that's got to be looking at the business risks and then mapping those through to the controls that we're putting in place. And I've got some, obviously on a radio, I can't show it to you, but some diagrams about how to go from cyber risk through a negative outcome, the scenarios for achieving that outcome, in other words, how might this happen, and then what are the strategies for achieving that, and what are the required tactics, and what are the specific techniques, and then specifically what actions within those techniques could I actually detect, because you can't prevent it if you can't detect it. You can't respond to it if you can't detect it. So looking at how I would be able to detect that and then building mechanisms for that detection if I don't already have them. When we talk about effectiveness and efficiency, that really links back to how the model that we've been using for 20 years in security. We look at IT and the infrastructure and say, what logs are available? Let me look at all the logs that are available to me. And then let's look for interesting stuff in that data and then try and build use cases around that interesting stuff. And then we back into that whole thing and say, well, I must have built a fairly secure model, a mature model, because I took all of the available information in my various log sources and built use cases around it. And that's actually completely backwards to the way it needs to be, which is look at the risk register first, identify all of the tactics and techniques that would be used to carry out the scenarios in the risk register items, and then look at the things that you would need to detect in order to do that, in order to notice it and prevent it or respond to it quickly, and create a desired state for your use cases. Then once I have those use cases, now those can drive what I'm actually going to find in my log sources. Then you can go look for the ability to find that information in your log sources, and from there you can derive whether or not you have those proper sources and you would be able to detect it, and if you don't, then you need to change that. Another thing that will lead to, though, is you may, by doing this exercise, and you talked about efficiency, by doing this exercise, you'll realize that you may have four different sources, four different tools that are providing you with the same detection capability, and yet you have a gap where you really need to be able to see information that will allow you to detect something going on. I'll give you an example, a really simple example, though, to highlight that. I was working with a financial institution, and we were going through their controls and the systems, how they were locked down, and we really weren't finding a lot of gaps. But I asked them, on your risk register, what's your biggest problem? They weren't sure about that, so we got the chief risk officer, and the chief risk officer's perspective was, what happens if managers in my company leave and the customer base with them? In other words, we have a lot of individual customers, tens of thousands of them. What happens if these managers leave and take that list, some of those lists with them, and pull our customers away? That's my biggest risk. So I ask a simple question. If a manager runs a report of customers, how many customers would they typically look at in a report? And the answer was maybe 10, 20. So if one of your managers runs a report and is running off a report with 1,000, 5,000 customers, would anything happen? Would anybody notice? And the answer was no. I said, well, you develop your own code, right? You develop your own systems, right? Yes. Well, let's go down the hall and talk to your developers. Guys, if somebody runs a report query with more than 100 customers, for more than 100 customers, I want you to create an alert and fire it off and point it to the SIM. And now when that happens, let's build a use case and let's build a detection rule and let's alert that person's manager so he can walk down the hall and say, Bob, what are you doing? Why are you pulling off that many customers? And it was a simple solution, simple problem, but it was a revelation to the organization that instead of looking at what are my available log sources and what are the tools I have and how can I use them effectively and efficiently, to think about what are you really looking for, what are the problems you're trying to solve, and do the tools that you have allow you to solve those problems, or are they duplicates on top of duplicates to solve a different problem, and do you have a gap where you really need to solve the problem? So that's one of the top ways that we can be more effective, and also at the same time look at how we're being efficient in the use of the funding for security.
Excellent. Sounds great. Now, finally, before the podcast, we were talking about AI and how you went to a conference and how pretty much everything, like conferences and what have you, everybody's talking about AI. Tell me all your thoughts, if you can, about AI in general, generative AI, ChatGPT, and how should businesses and companies be responding to these new tools that are coming out?
Well, it's actually... It follows the same process as any other project within an organization, any other new technology within an organization. The first step is, what are the risks that this poses? And there's 10 really fundamental risks to AI. It's not a great mystery. The first, not necessarily for other people in this order, but I just ordered them as uncontrolled use, like any other tool. Social media, for example, great tool. A lot of companies use it for advertising. Uncontrolled use of it by their employees, not so good. We found that out the hard way. It's a bit of a sidebar here, but when I was doing pen testing, one of the most interesting places I would find information about an organization is the Microsoft help desk. Publicly available. And people would go there and they'd say, well, my organization's got this version of the operating system with these patches and we're running these other pieces of software and I can't get this piece of software to load, or I'm having problems with that. And thank you very much for giving me all the background I need about what versions you're running, and now I know what I'm going to try and exploit. So again, uncontrolled usage of any new technology is problematic. Tightening it down too much discourages people from trying the new technologies. So it's really a matter of how you communicate that. But the bottom line is probably one of the biggest risks is not getting control over how it's being used. The next one is that I think of is data security and regulatory compliance. The problem is, one of the problems with AI is you don't know what it's going to spit out till it spits it out. And you don't know where it's going to fall out. So if you put any regulated data into it, then when it falls out and how it falls out and how it manifests itself as that information leaks back into your environment can be rather tricky. For example, if I put GDPR-type data in it, privacy data, into an AI system, and I'm using that AI system as a customer help desk or a customer chat bot. What's to say that data about customer A isn't going to get leaked back to customer B when they're asking a question. So you really need to look at data security, how you're tracking that data through the system and where it's going to be available. And then number three is output reliability and over-reliance on AI. We know that, interestingly, the more you feed an AI system, the more likely it is to produce hallucinations and fabrications. So we have to be aware that we can't be fully reliant on it. We can't take the human out of the loop to look at the information coming out and say, is this real? Is this realistic? Based on my judgment, my understanding, is this probable? And maybe do a little bit of additional research to validate that it's right. And it depends on the type of AI system, obviously. If you're using a system that's closed and you're using it for a very specific purpose, then that can be mitigated. But the more open it becomes, the more potential there is for fabrication. And AI systems don't make judgments. They look at what's the statistical, probable, best guess, and what follows in this sequence in order to emulate a human-like response. So they're taking tokens and looking for the next thing in that sequence of tokens. But they're not actually making judgments. And so using them to make a judgment is simply dangerous. And if you can't explain how you got there, then making your business reliant on a AI decision engine when you can't explain how you got to that decision and how that output was created is fully unacceptable. There's no way to back that up in court. Number four, I would say, okay, is output classification. If you generate new data based on information about your business, what's the data classification of that new data? Who's going to make that decision? I mean, can you leave it to the AI to decide what the sensitivity of the information is that it just generated, but somebody needs to classify it and make sure you track it and appropriately control it based on its classification? And then five, cyber attacks. The more you put into it, the more motivated attackers will be to attack that AI system, especially if it's a private AI system. I would like to, as a hacker, I would like to be able to ask that AI system questions just like your employees do. And then harmful output potential. It can create material that is harmful, offensive, explicit, misleading, advocates undesirable behavior, just a wide range of potential harmful output. And the more you customize it, the more potential there is for that, and the more open you make the AI system, the more potential there is for that. And, of course, everybody's familiar with output bias. Can you allow it to make a decision that affects someone? Some of the people I've talked to have been in the insurance business and HR, and we've talked about how you'll use AI in that environment, and they're deathly afraid of it because they understand that if they allow AI to have an AI-based decision and someone doesn't get coverage or someone's coverage is rejected or their treatment is rejected or they don't get a job because the AI system had it wrong and was biased against them, there can be litigation there. So that's a very serious problem. And the bottom line is I've played enough with it to know that it will make up an answer if it doesn't have the answer. In other words, I asked an unnamed AI system, give me a complete background on this particular individual. And I asked about this individual's upbringing, about their education, about their work history, and I said, you must include a full detailed background of all of their criminal offenses. And that person didn't have any criminal offenses, but I told the AI system, I insist that you provide a full background on all their criminal offenses. It made up stuff. obviously that can have a big impact if you're making decisions right. that impact people's lives based on false information like that. And the last yeah. three are ownership and copyright ambiguity. Do you really know who owns the material that comes out of generative AI? And if you look at the policies of some of these engines, they say you have to give credit to us if you generate things and this system produces it and you use it somewhere. But that's fine until you find that it's used information that it shouldn't have had to begin with because someone had leaked a person's transcript of a book, for example, an unnamed comedian who's currently got a lawsuit in that area, because the systems it was trained on across the Internet may contain things that are proprietary and copyright protected. And so do you have ownership of it? And I've seen a lot of companies writing policies where they're saying, anything that's generated by this generative AI system that's done created by an employee based on a prompt from one of our employees, the company owns that. Really, let's see how that holds up in court. It's a non-trivial right. business risk, and it's really not all there yet in terms of the regulations, the law around it, and then training and awareness. One of the things I've been striving for is to ensure that people who launch AI-based initiatives, be it strictly internal, it's something that they're going to use publicly, just make sure that they're aware of the risks and they're trained on what those experiments might yield and trained to deal with the unforeseen potential. So training and awareness, I don't believe you should restrict people in using AI, but I'd like to make sure that they ask, not permission, but ask guidance first and define what are the boundaries of their project so we can identify a swim lane for their AI project. And then, of course, swim as fast as you want, but stay inside that swim lane so we know that there are appropriate controls on it. And last but not least is I think the news just broke yesterday that one of the AI engines is now going to be free to search the live, real-time, open Internet. We were just getting used to the idea that it was going to give you information based on 2021. Now, real-time and live information, and you have absolutely no control over what gets put out onto the Internet at any given moment, which means that now your system is even less predictable, and these types of things are going to happen very quickly. That's a massive change that's happened just this year, and just this year most of these tools were launched. So I would say that of the top 10 risks, the rapid rate of change and the unpredictability of that change is something that everyone needs to be aware of when you're writing your policies. And that's where I think we want to drive all of the policies against the risks that we know. That's why I said it takes the same form that any other new tool takes. Okay, what are the risks with this new tool? Just like we talked about with social media, with going to the cloud, what's the risk of that? There was a time when we told people, some of us did, some of the more honest ones told people, the cloud's not ready for your most sensitive data yet. And it wasn't at that time. It is now. But again, it's assess the risks and then develop your policies aligned to those risks and be ready for rapid change, particularly in this area.
Okay. Excellent. I think one of the in terms of like the social impacts of AI, and I think an area it's going to be it has started and it will continue to even grow to proliferate even more, is that of using like ChatGPT for authors and writers. It's very easy just to say, hey, create a novel for me, create a book or whatever in ChatGPT. But I think recently there are a couple of lawsuits that were filed saying that the output that was produced by ChatGPT actually came from copyrighted material from previous books written by actual authors. So that's going to be an interesting thing. And I know that, I'm a tech writer. I'm an author myself. I know the publishers, and I think even Amazon, the Kindle Direct Publishing, they've really cracked down on using AI strict. If you use AI to create your whole book, they really are starting to crack down. I think even the KDP, I think they can block your account out for a long time if they suspect you used AI to create your whole content. Because nobody knows where, you know, the inputs are coming from to create that output, that content. It could more than likely be coming from copyrighted, you know, books, you know, that, you know, it's been used to train on. So that's going to be a new hot area, you know, especially in the writing world, I think, in my opinion. So.
Yeah, just like I said, several people have lawsuits already, and the bottom line is there's a lot of pirated material out there on the Internet. So there's a lot of unlicensed, essentially stolen material out there. There was a time when, Napster got put out of business because they were pirating music. And now look at YouTube. I mean, it's the same things that the lawsuits put them out of business is now promoted. I think that's unlicensed use. So if I ask AI to go to create something in the vein of a particular artist or writer, whatever the art form that I'm looking for, and it's going to go create based on what it learned about what's out there. And let's face it, a lot of what's out there is unlicensed, pirated material. So that's what it's going to train on. I like to think of it as it's an idea factory. It's not something you have it generate your work for. You do the work yourself and make it original. But it's an interesting idea factory. And if we can use it in that context as an idea farm, things that you might not have considered, additional things to look at. When I actually have used it to write some policies, or not write the policies, but give me ideas about it. In fact, my company's AI policy, a lot of the ideas came from AI. I'd ask it iteratively, what are the risks? What are the risks? What about this risk? What do you think about this risk? And eventually, the AI system and myself agreed on the top risks based on what it found out, and a lot of what it found out was hundreds of other researchers have done in the past and posted on the Internet. So between the two of us, we were able to come up with a really comprehensive list. But again, it's a nice idea factory, but it can't write the actual policy. It can help me identify risks and help me identify some gaps in the policies that I've written, but it can't write the policy because it doesn't make judgments. It doesn't know people. It doesn't know how they will respond. It doesn't know the impact of a policy on my business or on my employees. It can't make those kinds of judgments. And that's where, as long as people realize that it's a creative tool, but it doesn't make judgments, it's not always right, and it doesn't know the impact of those statements that it creates, that takes a person that has the experience to do that.
Well, you need both. I mean, you need that, and you need a human intervention. I think that's what the society, I think, here doesn't realize. They're all afraid of, you know, AI is going to replace jobs, it's going to do this, that. But in my opinion, it's just going to augment a process. You know, just as you said, you know, it's an idea for me. You know, can you give me some new ideas, or can you create something from a different angle? That's all it's ever going to be. I think the human brain, I mean, just to get up on a deeper topic, the human brain is so complicated we will never even understand it 100%. And if we do, it'll probably just be like 0.005%. And I remember my dad was a professor at Purdue. He was involved in spinal cord regeneration research. And I think he was on the verge of breakthrough, like right before he died of a heart attack. But he was saying that, you know, we will never understand the human brain. It's just so complicated. We won't understand the same way that we can understand the heart, like do heart transplants and, you know, stuff like that. It just won't happen. So I remember those conversations that we're having. I think if society can realize that, you know, it's an AI, I mean, at most fundamental level, it's just garbage in, garbage out. That's all it is. There's nothing mysterious about it. Maybe the algorithms, it's all, you know, it's kind of black box in between, but that's all it is. It's not going to replace, you know, jobs or anything like that. It's only going to, you know, augment. It may mean, maybe make things a little bit better, but that's about it.
Well, you point out some interesting bit of irony, I guess, in one of my earlier statements where I said the AI has an explainability problem. Well, so do we. And one of the things that explainability of the human mind, how did you reach that conclusion? Now, most of the time, you hope that a person can backtrack through it, list out the factors that were involved in the decision. But you're right, to some degree, there are personal biases and all sorts of things that they're not even aware of that are happening in their mind, in terms of other factors and experiences they've long since forgotten, but it left an imprint on how they made that conclusion. So we have an explainability problem. And we transmitted that explainability problem that we have into a machine and then cross-referenced that with thousands, if not millions, of other people's unexplainability until the point where we've made it even less explainable. And now, since we can't go back and say what were the conditions and what were the variables that you considered, I think that's going to come. I think that's going to happen, that we will insist that our AI systems in the future be able to state an answer to a question, create a solution, but also explain how they reached that conclusion and how they came up with that solution. That will be a demand of society, because if they can't, even though we know that there may be some subtle nuances in there, just like within us, where we can't completely explain how a decision might have been made, at least we can come up with a rationale and say, here's the steps I took to make it somewhat explainable, somewhat reasonable to an observer.
Yeah.
But like I said, you bring up an interesting point that we're not explainable and we can't expect it to be explainable.
No, it's quite a conundrum. But yeah, I mean, I love to have another podcast. I mean, just talk about AI in general. You know, I mean, it's just such a, you know, crazy topic. But anyway, cool. Well, Bruce, we thank you for your time this evening. Is there anything else more you'd like to add on? Or
just some of the things that I think are going to be really super valuable in that area. And in terms of, and we can link this back to SOC efficiency. Remember I said the biggest thing you need to be able to do is quickly, really obsessively quickly, identify when something suspicious is happening. But that's always been a question. You can't, as a friend of mine said back in the early 2000s, you can't identify, you can't find suspicious until you define suspicious. And
right.
That's something that I think AI will help us do, is monitor normal and try and explain even little anomalies that happen and see if there's a good explanation for it. And over time, as it builds and trains on the data, it'll be better at finding these little anomalies and alerting us. And that's a big factor in security operations. At my company, we've been working on AI projects since before I arrived at the company, at least 5 years, in ways to augment the SOC analyst, help them make decisions faster. And I think in that regard, it's going to be a great tool. The flip side of that is that as we get better at responding to things, we get faster at responding, the adversaries will use the same technology. And unfortunately, for us, they don't have to QA their products. They don't have to be right. If it breaks something, well. It's kind of like the old idea of the hackers versus pen testers. I started part of my career in that area, and I know that you were very careful as a pen tester. I'll admit this, early on in my career, we were doing a pen test on a call center, and the call center software they were using did not take kindly to being scanned aggressively. So when we were scanning it for vulnerabilities, we ended up crashing it and knocked down a 2,500-person call center for a number of hours. Let's just say we didn't get paid for that engagement. But the pen tester has to be very careful about what they break. Bad guys don't. So they don't QA their code, and things happen much faster in their environment. So what I foresee is that if we develop tools that are AI-enabled, and we say, when these sets of things happen, here's the response we'll take. And the first few times, that's brilliant, because we stopped the attack. We did it very quickly. We took those steps. We had the human look at it and say, yep, that makes sense. We'll go ahead and take that action. And we responded quickly. The bad guys won't take long at all to learn that, and their AI systems won't take long at all to learn that. So what they'll do is they'll deliberately trigger those sets of actions, get us to respond to one thing while they're going over and doing something else in a different area, or get us to respond so aggressively in a predictable manner that they understand how we're going to respond. They'll get us to respond aggressively in a way that we damage ourselves. It's kind of like in the mid-2010s, you saw people using the target to actually DOS themselves by manipulating the target systems to DOS themselves. Again, it's going to be an escalation of the AI bots in security, but I do think it will help us respond faster and respond more creatively by being able to spot suspicious faster and being able to help use that to reduce business risk and operate more efficiently. I don't think we're going to see fewer employees. What I think is we're going to see those employees upskill their game and be much more valuable employees, doing much more thought work, thought leadership work, and decision work, business decision work, as opposed to a lot of the things that drive employees crazy and drive them to leave anyway when they're stuck in doing mundane tasks that are repeated over and over again, and they learn to hate their job, get trained on something else and leave. This will alleviate a lot of the simple to-do lists and more repetitious tasks, and allow the employees to get better trained, upskill their game, and have more impact. So, kind of my prognosis for where this is going to take us.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting future. But anyway, Bruce, we thank you for your time. What's the best way for someone to get a hold of you in case they want to know more about, you know, your company or the service that you have to offer? What's the best way to have them contact you?
To contact the company through our website, cyberproof.com. But they can contact me directly. I'm on LinkedIn, Bruce Rotan at LinkedIn. And I also have my company email, bruce.rotan@cyberproof.com.
Okay. Well, Bruce, we thank you for your time, and we look forward to having you again on a future podcast.
Thanks for hosting me.
Thank you. Take care. Have a great evening.
Thank you. You too.